Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
I know she didn't run off. Like, she actually vanished into thin air. So, to me, I don't know. Your mind goes back and forth. And right now, you know, you can't point the fingers at anybody. You can't say, unless you know for sure or saw something with anything in life, you can't point your finger. You can speculate. My speculation, something's not right with just the stories I heard about Jeff's father taking him out of in the middle of a lie detector test. His test was inconclusive. He's not the type of person. I mean, I didn't know him. I knew him, you know, as long as Audrey and I became close again. But there were things that I'm finding out about him after she disappeared that I would have never expected either in, you know, their personal life. But I can't see him doing something to her on purpose.
On August 29th, 2002, 31-year-old Audrey Heron finished up her shift at a healthcare facility where she worked in Catskill, New York, around 11 p.m. She walked out to her Jeep with some coworkers and said goodnight. The night was dark and rainy. However, Audrey had been making the same commute for years. But Audrey's husband says that she never made it home and seemingly vanished into the night. Audrey has not been seen or heard from again. And despite extensive searches, the Jeep that she was driving is also missing. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 209 of The Vanished, Audrey Heron's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Audrey Heron was a beautiful person. She loved people, cared for others, and had a genuine personality that attracted others to her. We spoke with Audrey's mom, Shirley. And she told us what Audrey was like as a child and what life was like at home for her family.
Raymond is 65 and Audrey is 70. That's 5 years. I waited 5 years because I wanted one out of diapers. Now, I mean, I always planned on having two children, so I waited 5 years and then had Audrey. They got closer when they were more of adults, you know, because she had her friends, and he had his friends. Very little fighting in between them in the household. You know what I found out, Lo? I would wrap Christmas presents, and I'd put them under the tree. And then when I went to work, they would carefully open up the presents and look in them while I was at work. And then they would tape them back up. But they came and, you know, told me about that afterwards. But, you know, children are children, right? She was a very good baby. She didn't cry much, and it was very quickly that she did sleep a lot of the night. She's always been a very generous and kind person. Even as a child, she always gave her friends gifts and stuff like that. Teenager, she had her wild moment there. But basically, she was good, you know, nothing to get excited or panic over, anything. As an adult, she set her own rules, her own standards, her own what she wanted out of life. She turned into being a great woman. Her and I were very close when she got married and had children. Day didn't go by that we didn't talk. She was pretty awesome. She loved her family. I loved her children to death. You know, there was nothing on earth like her kids. She had lots of friends. She was the best.
As a young woman, Audrey had her oldest child, Sansia, and she doted on her young daughter. Sansia was only 10 when her mother disappeared, but old enough to remember all the things she loved about her mom. Sansia is now in her 20s, and we asked her to share with us what she remembers of her mother.
So my mom was extremely spunky. She was very independent. She was a great mom. She was, you know, very involved with us. She used to take me pretty much everywhere with her, shopping, to her girlfriend's house. I think I can remember her being away from home with her friends maybe once or twice overnight. She was funny, and I think she just knew how to make people feel good about themselves. And she was also someone that I looked up to when I was younger. You know, I had always wanted to be more like her and hoped that maybe one day I could be more like her. And from what I've heard from her friends, that she was a great friend. You know, she always listened. She was always there for them. So I've heard that she was great in that way, too. A good sister, daughter. She was always the one that kind of brought the family together in a way. You know, she would always make sure she was keeping in contact with everyone, checking in on everyone, the family, because on my mom's side, it's a pretty big extended family, and everyone isn't so close all the time. But I've heard she was always the one to reach out and try to bring everyone together, see how everyone was doing at least. I have a different father than my sister and brother. My mom remarried when I was about 5. So that's my stepfather. And my stepfather is my brother and sister's father. So when my mom went missing, I went to live with my father, my biological father, who I had always seen. You know, I saw him like every other weekend kind of a thing. And him and my mom would share holidays. So when mom went missing, I went to live with him, and my brother and my sister stayed with my stepfather. I remember her and what she was like, and I have many, you know, memories of her, you know, different things growing up. But I think my sister was, I might not be exact on the ages, but I want to say she had just turned 3 or 4. I think she has like a couple of memories, you know, maybe just like a handful of memories, and that's all that she has. And then my brother, he was not even 2. He was going to be 2 in a few months when my mom went missing, and he doesn't remember anything at all. It's very sad. You know, I know it would make my mom so sad to think that, you know, my brother Quinn doesn't remember her at all.
Audrey's relationship with Sansia's father didn't last, but she soon met a man named Jeff on a golf course where they both worked. Shirley told us what she knows about how Audrey and Jeff met.
Well, she was working at, they owned a golf course, and she was working at the golf course, so was I. They met that way. He was nice. He was friendly. He was courteous, polite. He was nice. I wasn't surprised because they went together, I think it was 6 or 7 months. They were seeing each other every day, and they were going out on dates to movies and to dinner. So I wasn't really surprised over them getting married. Plus, I knew that she really cared for him a lot, and I could tell just the way he acted that he really cared for her.
After dating for some time, Audrey and Jeff married and had 2 more children, Katie and Quinn. At 31, Audrey had it all. She had a nursing career she loved, 3 young children, a husband, and a brand new home on a golf course not too far from the long-term care center where she worked. She also had a group of friends that she enjoyed spending time with, taking their kids on play dates, and being moms together. We talked to one of her friends, Corina, and she shared with us what she remembers about her friendship with Audrey and raising their kids together.
I met Audrey in high school. She was new to the school, and I was new to the school, and, you know, just going to school together. I don't remember details, but, you know, we became friends in high school. She was just spunky, a very spunky girl. You know, I never remember her being a introverted person. She was always friendly with everybody and just full of energy. She was full of energy. That's how I remember her being, you know, when we were younger and as well as when we were adults. We drifted apart after high school. I moved out of the area and I think she moved, you know, not far, but she had met some other people, I guess. I had met other people, so we lost contact. And then I want to say, I don't even remember the exact year, but maybe around 93 and 95, she moved on. My mother had bought a house in 1991 in Coxsackie, New York. And Audrey had broken up with this one guy. And that's when we kind of lost contact. I think when she started seeing him, she had met Jeff Heron. They moved, they got married, and then moved into a house on the same street as my mother. My mother ran into her. So that's how I found out where she lived. And she had Sansia at that point. Sansia was probably 2 or 3 years old. And my daughter, Mariah, was just born. And then we just kind of, the girls, you know, they were a couple years apart. So we started doing things together with the girls, like, you know, Disney on Ice and, you know, like the kid things.
Audrey relished in her friendships with the women she'd gone to school with and reconnected with them when they had children to raise. We also spoke with Audrey and Corina's mutual friend, Marie, who told us more about her relationship with Audrey.
We went to school together, actually, for a little bit, and because she went to two different schools. I hadn't seen her for many years, and about 5 years before she disappeared, our kids went to school together. And we were sitting on a bar stool, not in like a bar, but we were at a Brownies Girl Scouts mother-daughter dinner or something. We didn't know it, but our kids were really good friends at school. So we were sitting there and talked about how she got remarried and that Sansia's dad took Sansia on weekends and just caught up and then became fast friends right after that. Like, we went everywhere together. She had a Jeep. I had a Jeep. It was crazy. Our girls were like best friends. They were like a week apart with birthdays. So we were always somewhere together because she was always at the mall. She was always taking Sansia shopping. Like, she was the mom that was the cool mom. She was a better mom than I ever thought of being. That's what I used to say, because she'd be going everywhere with the kids. I was always working. She literally left me a note one day. Hey, don't be mad. I grabbed the kid and, you know, the house is a mess.
On the evening of August 29th, 2002, Audrey finished her shift at work around 11 p.m. She walked out with a few coworkers and got in her Jeep to make the 15-minute drive home. This was a well-traveled route, and really the only one she could have taken without making a significant detour. But according to her husband, Audrey didn't make it home, and her Jeep disappeared along with her. When we spoke with her friend Corina, we asked her to walk us through what she remembers from the day she found out that her friend was missing.
God, I was in Albany, school shopping, and I had my two younger girls were little, I think a year old and 2 years old. And my daughter Mariah was in kindergarten or first grade. I was school shopping. So I was in Albany all day long. When I got home, probably about 4 or 5 o'clock that afternoon, there was a message from Jeff on my answering machine. And I remember exactly what it says. I mean, I still have that phone with the digital answering machine, but I don't use it, but you know, I saved it. But it said, "Hi, Corina, it's Jeff Heron. We're having trouble locating Audrey. If you've heard from her, please contact me." Now, this was, like I said, my answering machine said the time was about 1 something in the afternoon. So when I got home, that message was the first message. Then I started getting messages from all our girlfriends that we were mutual friends with saying, Karina, call me. Like, I just knew something wasn't right because his was the first message. Then my girlfriends were calling me with their messages, you know, call me, that's important. So that's how I found out. I never called Jeff back, but maybe I tried. I don't know. I ended up calling my friend Dawn Belarge. Audrey and I were very good friends with her and Marie. They told me what was going on. We actually met at my house. There was a few of us that met at my house. My mother came over and babysat for my kids. And I think it was myself, Mitzi, Dawn, and I think it was Marie and maybe Nellie. We had gone on foot over by one of the side roads that she would have driven. So we were looking for her vehicle, like off the road.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, and you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Corina and other friends of Audrey's wasted no time in starting the search for her. They went in groups up and down the roads Audrey would have traveled to and from work, made flyers, and started fundraising. Corina explained to us that at the time, she didn't think that this would last more than a few days and wanted to find her friend as quickly as possible.
I mean, when this first happened, you're thinking you're going to find her. You know, you're going to think there's got to be a logical explanation for this. She went off the road. You know, I mean, I remember exactly what I was doing that night. It was the 1 year special of the 9/11 kids that were born within that year. And so it was, must have been on 2020 or Dateline or something. And I was watching it and it was a rainy night that night. But you think back, okay, it was raining. She must have went off the road. We're going to find her. She's hurt somewhere. Hopefully she's not dead. We thought we were going to find her. And I mean, we looked for tracks. We looked for, you know, because it was fresh. This was one day after. There's really nowhere for her to have gone. She would have been on main roads, not highways. They're main county routes. until she got to Caniff Road, I think it is. That's the side roads that go, that she would be on for probably about 5 minutes till she got to her road. I mean, we walked that. We walked that next day. They walked it. They were up in helicopters.
While Audrey's friends were looking for her, her mother Shirley and daughter Sansia had just returned from a trip to Florida. And Shirley was expecting Audrey to pick up Sansia the next day after a doctor's appointment. When we spoke to Sansia, she told us her memories as a 10-year-old coming back from vacation excited to see her mom, only to discover that no one knew where she was.
It was kind of strange, only because, so around the beginning of August, I had actually left for Florida with my grandmother, my mom's mother. She had an RV that she had down on some land in Florida, and she was going down for the month of August, and I was going to go with her. And my sister and brother stayed home with my mom and my stepfather. So I had been gone for most of the month, and I came back, and I remember, it's kind of fuzzy, my memory, but I remember that mom was supposed to pick me up from my grandmother's, and my grandma said, you know, mom had something come up. I don't know if she said something about work or she had to do something else, but she would be here the next day to get me. And I think that was the actual day that my mom went missing, or maybe the morning after. And then the next day came and mom obviously was not there to come and get me. And I remember my grandma, I don't know why, because only my grandfather, it was only my grandmother and my grandfather home, but she said, you know, I want to bring you in the bedroom and talk to you for a minute. And I knew as soon as she said something, I knew something had happened to mom, especially because I was like, okay, mom was not someone that didn't, you know, I had just been gone for a month. And I had talked to her on the phone coming home from Florida when we were driving home. And she had said, you know, I can't wait to pick you up. I've missed you. You know, like, I don't want you going away for a month ever again. It was a long time to be away from home, especially at 10, you know? So as soon as my grandmother said, you know, I got to talk to you in the bedroom, I knew something had happened to my mom. And she sat me down and she said, you know, nobody can find, you know, mom, but, you know, we're going to find her. There's a lot of people out there looking for her. She didn't make it home from work, so she might have just gotten into an accident, and nobody's found her yet, but we're going to find her. And she like reassured me that everyone was doing everything they could to bring her home or try to find her at least. What happened next was I went back to my mom's and stepfather's house to get some of my belongings because I was going to go and stay with my dad until mom came back. So I went back to my stepfather and mom's house. I remember there was a lot of police officers there. I remember that. And I got my stuff and I went and I stayed with my dad, and that's where I stayed after that.
Although it was 2002 and not everyone had a cell phone, Audrey did, and she kept it in her Jeep. Along with Audrey and the vehicle, the cell phone is also missing, and police were not able to ping it because it was disconnected, turned off, or had a dead battery. When we talked to Sansia, she described for us what her mother was wearing and what was in the Jeep at the time she disappeared and the vehicle vanished too.
I have heard that she had forgotten her purse, so that was actually at home is what I heard. And also, again, I don't know like how the validity of all this, but so her Jeep, there was some baby clothes in the back of the Jeep that she was supposed to be giving to someone that also are missing. It's probably my brother's or my sister's clothes. But other than that, she did have a cell phone. It was one of those, it was like in a little suitcase and you unzipped it and it was like a cord phone. There was never any activity on the cell phone. She kept it in her Jeep. She didn't take it out of the Jeep. She did wear glasses, although I don't know if she was wearing them that night, to be honest with you. She didn't always wear them, but sometimes she did. The scrubs she was wearing, I think they were green, and she was wearing a green turtleneck underneath of them, is what I've been told.
Since Sansia was with Audrey's mom, Shirley, we asked Shirley to walk us through what she remembers and how she found out that Audrey was missing.
Jeff called me to find out if she had come to my house. She did that every once in a while, you know. She would come over and we would have, we call it girls' night. She would come over maybe once a week and spend the night, and we'd order out, rent some tapes. We'd watch TV and catch up on the local gossip and stuff like that. So, but he called me, I think it was like at 6. I really didn't think very much of it because I knew my daughter, she would do something like that. But normally she would call Jeff and let Jeff know that she was doing this. So that's how I found out. And then I dozed back off. I had Sancia, her oldest daughter. We had just gotten back from Florida the day before that week. And when I got back up, I can't remember who called me, but someone called me and told me that they couldn't find her. And then, of course, it was panic then. After I woke up and found out that they couldn't find her, you know, and that she didn't call up Jeff to let her know that she would spend the night with maybe Mitzi or me, or I was panicky. So I immediately got dressed, headed out to her house, and I was scared. Just wanted to know where the hell she was, that bottom line, you know.
Audrey's friend Marie was at work when a call came in that Audrey had left work the previous night and never made it home. At first, Marie thought this was a joke, but she quickly realized that something was wrong and headed out to start the search with the others. Here's Marie.
I got the phone call. I was working out of town. It was construction. And I had talked to Audrey out of town, and the last person I talked to was her husband. It was the night before she went missing, or the night that she went missing. I can't remember. Because I called from the hotel because we'd get done with work, and I'd just, you know, call and chit-chat. Her favorite thing to leave on the voicemail was, "Hey, woman, where are you?" So that's what I say in my mind all the time. "Hey, woman, where the hell are you?" So I had called, you know, she was at work. Okay, well, tell her I called. See you later. Regular conversation. And the next day at work, that Friday, I got the phone call. And I just said, "Hey, I'm going to stay and spend the night out here." I was in Binghamton. It was like a 3-hour ride. And Jimmy had beat me. I didn't answer it. And he called my boss. And they get me on the phone. And he's like, "Marie, Audrey's missing." And I laughed at him. So, but when he told me, I was like, "Okay, she's not at the mall." He's like, "No, she's missing." And I'm like, "Wait a minute. Okay, Sancia's in Florida." And for some reason, I thought like she flew to Florida with her grandmother. I forgot they had taken, like, you know, the RV or something. And so we'll check the airport. Like, Sancia's supposed to be coming home. He's like, "No, Marie, she's missing." So I kind of just dropped the phone, looked at my boss and said, "I got to go."
One thing we know about the night that Audrey disappeared is that around 9:30, she called home and spoke to Jeff. She was in good spirits and shared that she had just gotten a raise. Marie recalls that Audrey's husband Jeff always wanted to know where Audrey was and when she would be home, except seemingly on the night of her disappearance. She told us about some of his strange behaviors between the time Audrey disappeared and the time he started calling her friends, family, and the police.
So the story goes, phone call, 9:30, right? She was happy-go-lucky, she got a raise, he talked to her, she was giggling, laughing. The Jeff I know, because literally didn't think about it until after the fact, she would have to call him no matter where we were. I was a freak. I never let anybody drive. She would park her truck in my driveway, put her keys in my house, and we'd go. She'd have to call him. She'd have to let him know when she was leaving, where we were. And when she was leaving my house, one night, she forgot to call him. He called, like 5 minutes after she left. And I said, "Yep, she's on her way." So he knew where she was at all times. All times. So 9:30, phone call. You know she's coming home at midnight, right? Or 11 o'clock, she should be home, but 11:30 at the latest. He wakes up, supposedly, at 2 o'clock in the morning. The kids are sleeping on the floor, which I just can't see that. And he decides to do dishes. He doesn't call the hospital looking for her. The only phone call, forgive me if I'm wrong, but the only phone call that went in from Jeff to that hospital was about 6 a.m. the next morning. A couple of them, around 6 a.m. Why would you call at 6 a.m.? Because he said, "Oh, you know, I did dishes, went to sleep, figured she just, you know, decided to work overnight." Why would you call at 6 o'clock in the morning looking for her? Why wouldn't you wait until 7:30 when she didn't come home? Because next shift would be 11 to 7. You understand what I'm saying? So that was the first thing that kind of irked me. but I didn't say anything.
When Audrey didn't return home from work on the night of the 29th, her husband Jeff reported her missing early the next morning. With not only Audrey missing, but also her vehicle, the police immediately jumped into action, pulling all of their resources to look for Audrey. Sancia told us more.
They were doing massive ground searches in the area. It's about a 15 to 20 minute drive. They searched her whole entire route home, you know, in the woods, the bodies of water. I think there was even a few air searches that they did. I know that my father, you know, they were looking at him for a while. We held some vigils for her immediately after she went missing at her place of work, since that was the last place that she was ever seen. But I think at first, a lot of people thought it was an accident because her Jeep is also missing with her. So I think at first, a lot of people thought, oh, you know, maybe she just kind of went off the road or, you know, went into a body of water and, you know, we're going to find her in the Jeep, because that's, you know, usually I think what happens when you have a missing person in a vehicle, it's usually some kind of an accident. But from what I've been told, they very, very thoroughly searched her route home. It isn't like there is another route for her to take. It would have been pretty out of the way.
Sancia believes that the law enforcement officials assigned to find Audrey have worked diligently on her mother's case, and they continue to take all the information that comes in seriously.
You know, I think for the most part, they've taken most leads that they get seriously, but I think it's just the lack of evidence in her case that makes it hard to really investigate. So I've only called them a handful of times. And I mean, every time that I've called them, they usually aren't there when I first call. I usually have to leave a message, but they return my call. They've always returned my call. So they have. They've been cooperative. And my grandmother said they've always been cooperative with her as well.
Audrey's friend Karina also believes that law enforcement has done what they can, including continuing to work on new tips. When we talked with her, she discussed some of the tips that have come in and how some of the details have been confused among Audrey's friends.
I would have to say that the police, even though our area is desolate and they don't have cases like this every day, you know, you would hope to know that they would know what to do. They were looking, they were taking tips. I didn't really get involved with the police too much. Marie, I just remember her being more involved, as I don't know if it's like scenarios that people put in their head. Like Marie has these stories about, oh, her cigarette case. She had her cigarettes and a cigarette case and her purse were left at the house. I don't know if the police said that. I don't know if they can tell you that. Or sometimes people make, not that they intend to make things up, but did that really happen? Was her purse really there? Was her cigarette case really there? I don't know if it was Audrey's father that had originally told Marie this. I came up with the idea, my first thing, because this is, I don't know, it was my first thought, was a reward. If we got a reward, if someone had her, they're going to give up her up for a reward. I was brought down to the police station, me and some other people, for questioning. And then I believe it was there that I had mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned it to the police or if I mentioned it, Marie remembers me saying it, to have a reward. And as far as the police, there were some people that said, I never got questioned. So I think they were doing their job. I think they were doing their job as well as they could do their job, you know, but I'm not 100% sure of what they did. I know that they were going around in, I think, helicopters and stuff like that. They were doing dives in ponds and lakes and stuff around here. If there was a tip, if someone called, I think they would follow it. I mean, they said they were doing that. I believe they were doing that.
As the search for Audrey progressed, it became clear to her friends and to law enforcement that Jeff wasn't interested in participating or cooperating with police. News articles from the time indicate that Jeff claims he has always cooperated with police and that he took a polygraph exam. But the people in Audrey's life find it suspect that Jeff wouldn't be out searching for his wife and the mother of his children. One of the first things that stuck out to Audrey's friend Karina was that Jeff didn't call her looking for Audrey until the afternoon after she disappeared. And even more strangely, the message he left on her answering machine had an unexpected tone.
It's just strange that he waited until 1 something in the afternoon to contact me, knowing I was one of her very good friends and we spend time together. So why wouldn't you have contacted me? Why didn't he call me at 7 o'clock in the morning? Even if he didn't want to call me at 6 o'clock in the morning, she was supposed to be home at 11. Even if he didn't want to call me at 6 o'clock in the morning, why didn't you call me at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning? I remember his voice on it. And it was very, very sad. It said, "Hi, Karina. It's Jeff Heron. We're having trouble locating Audrey. If you've heard from her, please call me. Thank you." And that's like exactly how he was, just very low-toned. He sounded sad. But you know what? Now that I just said that out loud, because I've never thought about this before, why did he sound sad? This is 17 years and I've never thought of this until I just said that out loud. Why did he sound sad and not, "Karina, it's Jeff. Listen, give me a call. Audrey never came home last night. Please call me." You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, maybe not excited voice, but if he didn't know where she was, at that point still though, that's, well, 11 o'clock. So that's 14 hours after she was supposed to be home. You still don't know. You're still thinking she's going to come home. You're not going to think that someone killed her. Unless, did he sound sad because he thought maybe she left him for another man or something? But wouldn't you have an indication that that was happening?
Were Audrey and Jeff arguing that night? Karina doesn't believe so, because she said that Audrey called home from work to share the happy news that she had gotten a raise. Would she have made that call if they were having a dispute? But Karina believes there are a host of other possibilities, too. There was a significant period of time where Karina believed that Audrey was going to leave Jeff because he didn't treat Audrey's oldest daughter very well.
So Katie was born in 98. Quinn was born in 2000. She was leaving Jeff in 99. I got married in November of 99, and she brought Jeff to my wedding. She was leaving him in 99. I think the whole reason why they were breaking up or broke up back in, I think it was mainly because of Sancia, the way he treated her. I don't know. There must have been conflict. I don't think he was hitting her. I think I would remember that, or I would tell her, you know. I think it had something to do with Sancia and the way he treated Sancia. Sancia was, I mean, all her kids were her world, but Sancia was her world. You know, she was her firstborn. I was close with Sancia. I didn't really get to know the other two. And what's weird is that, so when she came to my wedding, she had asked Jeff to be her date. But they were still sleeping together. And I don't know if I knew this then, but I found out afterwards that they were still sleeping together. And that's when she got pregnant and she ended up going back to him. Sia and my daughter, Mariah was about, I don't know, 2 years old. Sancia was 5. And they lived in Coxsackie at the house in Coxsackie. And they called him the boogeyman. And he used to yell. He was very strict with Sancia, and this was before him and Audrey had kids together. I just remember him being very strict with her. She was a spoiled kid, and she threw her temper tantrums, and she was in her mother's eye. She, you know, and Audrey didn't take that from her, but so I don't know if it was maybe not your child type thing. It's your wife is letting her get away with stuff and it's annoying you, so you're going to be the strict one. It's easier for you to be the strict one because it's not your kid. But my daughter and her, and Santino used to call him the boogeyman because he used to yell at them for every little stupid thing. Oh, you can't bring drinks in the living room because you're going to spill them, or you can't do this, or you can't do that.
After Jeff and Audrey reconciled, they started building their dream home on Jeff's father's golf course. Karina told us about the last time that she saw Audrey.
They had moved from Coxsackie, they moved to Freehold, and then they were building their house. A week before she disappeared, I went to her house because they were changing houses, and their old house was down the street. I think it was one of his father's houses there on the golf course. They were building a house. They had a dog house for their dog, and she didn't want it anymore. And I came over, and my husband had come over separately with his truck, his pickup truck, to put the dog house in there. So Jeff was golf course, and it was weird because he came there. He must have saw our vehicles in the driveway, and he came there, and it was kind of like, oh, who's here, you know, type thing. That was the last conversation I really had with her, because we talked about, she was still in her pajamas. It was a Saturday afternoon. She must have been cleaning and stuff like that. But we talked about getting together and coming over and playing cards. I wasn't a card player, but my husband, her and Jeff were. And I remember her saying, oh, we'll teach you how to play.
Not all of Jeff's behavior was suspicious. He didn't help look for Audrey or seem to be emotionally overcome by her disappearance. But he did contribute to the fundraiser Audrey's friends were doing to raise money for a private investigator. Corina told us more about the fundraiser.
When this first happened, we were so engrossed with this. In the beginning, we were always on our computer. I was neglecting my family because of this. And my girls were little. I was downstairs in our family room in the basement on the computer. You know, we started joining all these different missing person things and boards and talking to other people and trying to come up with ways to get reward money. Jeff did give us $1,000 towards that reward fund. But so did another girl that we went to school with whose mother was murdered. We went door to door selling Hoffman car wash tickets. It's a big car wash company around here. And we went door to door. We had them made up. It was for the Audrey Heron Missing Fund or whatever the heck it was. And we went door to door in Coxsackie, the town that her and Jeff were living at, like before that. Because around here, the houses are really far apart. But in Coxsackie, where my mom lives, where Audrey and Jeff lived in their first home, there's streets and blocks and the houses are close together. So we literally went door to door, miles and miles, and we sold these Hoffman car wash tickets. And this one girl she gave us $1,000. And I was like, at first I wouldn't take it because I'm like, all right, this isn't legit. Who that didn't know this person is going to give us $1,000? But it ended up, I knew her cousin, and her cousin was like, no, it's legit. Please cash the check. Her mother was murdered. And it was this whole big story. So I was like, oh my God. So this person that didn't even know Audrey gave us $1,000 towards the reward fund. And her husband gave us $1,000. His father had a lot of money. He's very wealthy. And it's just, that was weird to me. Like, he should have been out there helping us.
Jeff may have had valid reasons for staying out of the way, and Karina acknowledges that this is a distinct possibility, but still has trouble coming to terms with the fact that he never seemed interested in actually finding Audrey.
The only thing I have ever heard, and I don't remember if I heard it from, I don't know if it was Sancia or another friend, or the reason why is because he didn't want his kids out there in the media. And that's another thing, is if one of my loved ones, one of my friends, because it's happened, and we were out there raising money for a reward. We were out there doing bike runs and, you know, all these things to keep her name and her face out there. And it's like, this is your wife? Where are you? Why aren't you here with us trying to find her? And that's very frustrating. I don't talk to him. And Sancia's brother Quinn and my middle daughter were in the same grade together. And, you know, we would occasionally see each other. And they were actually in the same class together one year. I never talked to him, never talked to him about it. I'd love to.
While Jeff's behavior was seen as suspect by so many, there was one person who told Audrey's friends she didn't believe Jeff was involved, and she had no reason to defend Jeff. Here's the story as Corina remembers it.
I talked to an ex-girlfriend of his. This woman was one of my very good friend's sisters, and her and I had a conversation probably 2 years ago, I want to say, on the phone. She now lives in Florida, but they worked at the resort together at the golf course. She didn't seem like his type, kind of rough girl, very nice girl. Who am I to say what his type was? But just, she wasn't anything like Audrey. You know what I mean? Nothing like Audrey. Something happened on Facebook, but I called her and I said, you know, it had something to do with Katie. I was like, what the hell is going on? And so we started talking. And she told me that Audrey's stuff is still up. Her clothes were still in the closet. That he never got over her not being there. But she told me that no way had he had anything to do with her disappearing. But you're not going to tell somebody, in my mind. I'm like, well, even if he did, he's not going to tell you. Maybe I said that to her too. He's not going to trust anyone, but they don't have a relationship anymore. She lives in Florida now, and they kind of don't even talk. She made the comment that he doesn't like fat girls. She made the comment that, you know, he was just basically using her, but she became very close with his kids, especially Katie. She keeps in contact with Katie.
This story is one with many possible outcomes, ranging from a car accident on a rainy night to murder. One of the more odd theories includes ties to the Russian mob. The golf course that Audrey and Jeff had built their new home on was owned in part by a silent partner, who was believed to be a Russian national involved in organized crime.
You know, everyone's talking about this Russian mob that his father was involved with. And I don't know much about that. I don't ever remember her talking about that. But people are saying, yes, Ron, Jeff's father, was involved with the Russian mob with his business. And like, in my mind, I think if maybe they got into a fight, I can't see her ever backing down. She was a little girl, but like I said, she was pretty spunky, and I could see if anyone tried to hurt her, she would put up a fight. And if those two got into a confrontation, maybe something accidentally happening. So maybe Jeff, maybe he knows something. Maybe, you know, this Russian mob thing, maybe, hey, as far-fetched as that sounds, maybe, in my mind, maybe that's why he's not talking about it, because there is a Russian mob connection, and he knows that, so he's not going to risk his family, and that's why he's protecting his kids, because I don't know. Or did something happen accidentally? Because according to the police records that I heard, that his father, he calls his father in the middle of the night. In my mind, there's either the scenario that there is this Russian mob thing, so for him not to have anything to do with the media, like, that's why I think, as far-fetched Russian mob thing, I don't know the details, but it's either that or he had something to do with it. You know, that's my only conclusion.
Audrey's friend Marie remembers the rumors about a Russian tie-in to Audrey's disappearance, but she doesn't put much stock into that theory. We asked her what she thought about it.
The Russian. So Gary Rudzinski is the Russian connection. He is the silent partner that brought Smullinger's, that is now Thunderheart, with Jeff's dad. He's the Russian connection. The person that brought, and I remember it like it was yesterday, talking on the phone with Jeff, because I'd be like that annoying Penny. I would call him up and say, hey, what's going on? We'd chit-chat a little bit. And I asked him one day, I'm like, what's the Russian thing? He goes, well, you know, Audrey walked in some kind of fight. They were going to evict the Russians. And in turn, I turned around and I said to him, I'm like, well, Jesus Christ, if you thought it was dangerous, why'd you let her be there? Like, that was my answer. And then he slowly stopped talking to me because I got a little lippy. I asked him one day, I said, you know what, Jeff? I have to ask you. You know, she's my friend. Did you have anything to do with this? He didn't say no right away. He didn't say too much of anything. And there was like that silent minute. And he says, oh, you know me better than that. Do I? Why wouldn't you just say no and get mad at me? And I laughed off and said, you know me better than that. And that's exactly where I am. Like that whole Russian theory. So you think the Russians took your wife. And why did you pick up stakes and take those kids out of there? Why did you still work at that same store? Like, I'd be leaving town. I'd be terrified. Oh, well, they only take the wife. Are you kidding me? Why are you staying right where they took her? Like, that makes no sense.
While the Russian mob theory seems unlikely, Audrey's friends did have reasons to be suspicious of Jeff. Karina doesn't understand Jeff's behavior after Audrey's disappearance and thinks that it makes him seem like he knows more than he's let on.
If someone is guilty, wouldn't they try to play off that they're not guilty and talk to as many people as they can with anything? It's like you can't accuse somebody of anything unless you know for sure. Do I have my suspicions as to why he's not cooperating? Yes. It points the finger at somebody. When they don't cooperate like that, it makes them look guilty. That doesn't mean they're guilty. Anybody, one of my kids or even my ex-husband, who I don't like, if he went missing, you're damn straight, I'm going to talk to them so they don't look at me as the one that had anything to do with it. And that's the thing. It's like she disappeared August, the end of August 29th. I want to say it was 10 months after she disappeared that Montel Williams contacted us to go on the show. When we were there, we found out that they contacted Jeff, I want to say a month or two after her disappearance, to ask him to come on the show. And he declined. So that was freaking frustrating. Like, how dare, what do you mean? She was only missing 2 months and you did, I would do anything and everything to try to find clues to where she is or what happened to her. You know, and to have him, that's what's frustrating about this whole thing, is him not doing what he needs to do as her husband, as the mother of his kids. The last Crime Watcher, I think that's what they were called, 2 years ago when we did that interview, she literally knocked, I mean, and they videotaped her knocking on his door and there was no comment. And then they went up the street to his father's house and he was out mowing the lawn. And so she talked to him. They interviewed him. After watching that, it was like, does he really know what happened to her? Like, we always kind of speculated that he had, you know, with the Russian mob thing, he had something to do with this. But after watching that, he's kind of like cocky in it. But then he didn't give off too many signs that he knew what happened, you know? So that's what's weird. But I don't know. There's no way she would have left her kids. No way. I would bet my life on that didn't happen. The only thing that makes sense in my head is it has to do with something with the business, with the company. I mean, I don't know. I didn't really know Jeff's father. I met him a couple times, you know, been in the same presence with him, but I don't know him. Yeah, so as far as his actions, it makes me feel like he had something to do with something. But you can't say that because you don't know. You know, and I'm sure the police probably feel the same way.
Jeff's actions after Audrey disappeared certainly confused those around her. Her friends recall that he constantly called and asked where she was and when she would be home, which seems kind of controlling. And Karina says the kids were afraid of him, too.
The other things that don't make sense with Jeff is that he always had to know where she was. If she said she was going to be home at 10 o'clock and at 10:05 she wasn't home, he'd be calling us if he knew that she was with us. We had little kids. We didn't go out. We had, if it didn't have to do with our kids, taking them to plays and all that stuff, we were having candle parties or coffee together, you know? I mean, so we didn't go out and we weren't out, you know, drinking and partying. And my mother even remembers that because when we lived in Coxsackie, you know, they lived on my mom's street and I lived around the corner in an apartment complex. Her and I were together. My mother remembers an incident that he was out, you know, waiting for us, waiting for me to drop her off on the porch.
And Karina has even more questions about Jeff after investigators indicated that he wasn't being fully cooperative and had only gone through part of a polygraph exam.
So I want to say 2 years ago, I think it was Crime Watch, that Sancia, Marie, myself, Audrey's mother, Shirley, and Katie, her daughter, Sancia's sister, Katie, did an interview with us. And one of the police, I would have to watch it again, but one of the investigators that have been on this case, I think Kaminsky is his name, and he's a retired trooper, and he's going to be the sheriff now for Greene County, for our county. He, I believe, said on that interview that, you know, they did a lie detector test, and it came back inconclusive. I want to say that might have been the show that he said that on. So I knew that was the truth then, that what I heard what in the beginning, that his father pulled him out of the test, the lie detector test. Why would you do that? Let him do what he needs to do so they know that he had nothing to do with this. So why take him out of that? See, those are the things that don't make sense.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. Audrey's friend Marie was able to share more about the investigators' participation in the Crime Watch Daily episode, and also what another officer later said about Jeff's polygraph exam.
You watch the one cop because they all think he's guilty. They're all pissed that they couldn't get at anything. But the one thing that sticks in my mind that makes it so that I'm not 100% on Jeff is Darlin. He was the chief at the time. I went in to see him one time and said to him, I'm like, well, did he pass the test? And he goes, you repeat this, you know, I'll deny it. Jeff was cooperating. He said it. He was cooperating until his father walked in and grabbed him and took him out with a lawyer. He wanted to kill his father because he was just trying to, and Jeff was cooperating. So in Jeff's mind, he probably thinks, you know, he was cooperating and he thinks he passed the test. He didn't.
The reporters from Crime Watch Daily attempted to make contact with Jeff when they were covering Audrey's story, but he refused to come to the door. They were, however, able to speak to Jeff's dad, Ron, who lived across the street. Marie told us about the reporter who was determined to speak with Jeff.
She did not want to leave town. She wanted to talk to Jeff so bad she went. There's like partial video of her knocking on his door, but she walked right up to his door. Before she left town to go back down to the city, his dad, she got that son of a bitch on camera. I couldn't believe it. And it's the only time he's been on camera. And he's sitting very arrogant on his lawnmower, kind of laughing it off that he's the one with the money and, oh, Jeff, this. But she asks him what he thinks happened. And he proceeds to talk about Russians and how she was put in a container. And but when he's saying it, now when some people are explaining something, it's almost like they can see what they're explaining. Like he was reliving watching her get put into a container. Everybody said it.
Clearly, Corina wasn't the only friend who was bothered by Jeff's behavior. Marie shared some of her memories of Jeff prior to Audrey's disappearance that made us wonder even more why Jeff didn't go look for his wife.
He was always strange anyways. Like, not highly, but, you know, he seemed like he was the husband that would watch the kids. But then when you put it all together, she never had the two little ones. And, like, little bits and pieces started coming out from everybody else. It came out that the description was, you know, the turtleneck, the scrubs, blah, 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 and a number one mom necklace. If I meet you, I'm going to remember the earrings that you're wearing. I'm going to remember something stupid about you. She always had something different. She was one of those. So the only number one mom thing that it could have possibly had, which I don't remember it, but we were in the kitchen in my house one day. Do you remember the little kid, like little jewelry that looked like kids? The little necklaces. So she had two of them on a, like a, you know, one of those clasps that would open up. Whether or not that thing said number one mom on it, I don't recall. I don't think so. It was like just a fancy one and had the two things on it. And I said, oh my God, like how come there's not three? And that's what she said to me. Well, Jeff didn't want to get one. And she kind of sort of told me that Jeff wasn't a fan of Francia, but we just kind of let it go. I didn't really open that can of worms.
The story about Audrey's necklace with only two children on it is sad and frustrating if it's true. But ironically, there's one person who remains protective of Jeff and his actions. And that's Audrey's oldest daughter, Sansia. She explained to us that the media has portrayed him in a suspicious light, and that's why he no longer gives interviews and wouldn't speak with us.
You know, going in, they just made my stepfather look like he was guilty. Which I understand, obviously, it has to be touched upon because in missing or murdered women, the husband is always a suspect. And really, he's never been cleared as a suspect, but also there's no evidence. You know, I lived with them and like they argued, but I wouldn't say it was anything that wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like explosive arguments. He never hit her or was abusive towards her. You know, and most of their arguments were because I was, you know, like this hyper 9-year-old. And I think my stepfather was like, oh my God, I can't deal with this girl, you know. They did split up for some time before, for like a year. And they had just gotten back together when my brother, like right around the time she got pregnant for my brother, they were trying to work on things. And then they got back together. But they never divorced. They just kind of separated for a little while. The way he doesn't want to talk to the media sometimes doesn't portray him in the greatest light. There are people out there that think he is guilty of it, but I just personally feel I could never imagine him actually harming my mom. That's like just from my own perspective. But he's not portrayed in the greatest light from the media. So it's hard. And that's why my sister has a hard time, because it's her, you know, it's her father. She was so young, you know, she was 3, maybe 4, you know, it had just turned 4. I can't remember. But that is my mom. She barely remembers. And then my stepdad is, you know, the only parent she's, you know, ever had, really. So
when we talked to Audrey's daughter, Sansia, she told us that she's heard different stories about what happened to her mom as she's grown up. We asked her to tell us some of what she's heard, and she told us about a man her mom worked with, and another man who hung around the facility that Audrey worked at because his mom worked there.
A lot of the things I've heard are, you know, rumors, so I don't know the validity really of most of it, but I have heard some rumors that there was a person in maintenance at her job that was like kind of flirty towards my mom. And I guess my mom was, you know, friendly back. And then it started getting like too much. And my mom kind of like backed off and was like, all right, you know, I'm not interested in that kind of way. You know, wasn't friendly anymore, because I think this person was kind of taking it the wrong way. They did recently, I think, I want to say like 2016, maybe. So this guy, he didn't work. This guy that the lead was about did not work at the nursing home at all. His mother did. But he had been at the job, like visiting his mother or stopping by to drop something off to his mom or, you know, something like that while my mom was working there. So they think maybe he kind of just saw her in passing, but I don't think they really knew each other. They drained this man's pond. So definitely, you know, there's this man that they named a suspect, and I guess he still is. From what I've gathered, he isn't really a nice guy. Like, he doesn't really seem like someone my mom would have really talked to. So he, I guess, didn't really have a relationship with my mom, but this man's mother was a secretary or some kind of clerical work at my mom's job. And he had been there, you know, a handful of times to visit his mother at work. So they're thinking maybe he just had seen my mom. And I guess they went off of this because of a tip that was given to them, like a letter or something was given to them, to the police. And also this man had like a pretty violent history. He had a history of rape and like attempted kidnapping.
Audrey's mom, Shirley, also remembered someone at Audrey's job that made her uncomfortable. And she believes that this person was involved in her disappearance. Here's Shirley.
She walked out with 2 or 3 other girls. Of course, they were in the one parking lot, and she was like in front of the building. There was this guy that had a crush on her at the nursing home. At the time, she told me about it, you know, that this guy was talking to her and paying attention when he was there. He didn't work there. She told her husband that the same thing. I think this guy, after finding out about this guy, which I can't mention his name or anything because, you know, lawsuits and all that, I think that he's a pretty bad guy. He's been convicted of rape, a lot of other things. Actually, I think he's in jail right now. But that's what I think. And he lived within walking distance of the hospital. Her Jeep, she didn't always lock it. Sansia told me that the back don't lock it. So she's so tiny. I mean, she only weighed 103, 105. I think that he was waiting for her in that Jeep. When I talked to Fitz Morris, he was in jail for perjury. He said I don't know the whole situation, but something about his eyes and he couldn't drive. They got him on a picture of him with sunglasses on driving. So it was something to do with that. He didn't go into the case with me or anything else, but that's where he was. I'm hoping that they're still investigating him, because they said it would take time because there's, you know, lots of witnesses and lots of people you have to go through.
When we spoke to Audrey's friend Karina, she told us about this same man that Shirley is suspicious of.
Yeah, so as far as I know, they do check out any tip or lead that if someone were to call. At least 2 or 3 years ago, there was another tip. Somebody's mother worked with Audrey. but she wasn't a nurse. She was like in the office or something. And this guy was like a creepy kid. He got into trouble, and his sister was the one that wrote a letter to the police saying that he had ties to Audrey. They did check it out. He had gotten in trouble. I don't know if he tried to rape somebody, and then that all tied in with Audrey and his sister. I work at a maximum security prison now. I've been there almost four years. So I work in the regional medical unit. So I have, I'm the administrative assistant for a 60-bed long-term care unit for these sick inmates. And some of them are terminal. And a couple of my CNAs actually worked with Audrey. One of the housekeeping guys, he worked with Audrey also. And they remember this guy that a couple years ago that they investigated. And his sister is the one that said something. But then they're like, well, his sister was pissed off about him about something. Even if you're mad at your sibling, are you really going to say? Like, she wrote a letter, I think, to the police or something that said that she had something to do with the disappearance of Audrey Heron. They went and they drained the pond that he, at the time, lived in, or the family lived in. That was the last known tip that I remember, that I know of.
While working on this story, we had a lot of questions. We were able to get approval to speak with an investigator from the New York State Police.
My name is William Fitzmaurice. I'm the senior investigator at the State Police in Catskill. I've been a member of the State Police for 30 years and a member of the Bureau of Criminal Investigation for approximately 20.
Senior Investigator Fitzmaurice told us more about Audrey being reported missing.
We received a phone call from our division headquarters up in Albany, which is about 30 miles north of our barracks. And there was a family member that worked in division headquarters. That's how the report was made. I think the family started talking in the early morning. The family members were talking, and then the family member that worked at division, talked to somebody at work and basically said, "What do we do?" And they called us. And then they called down to us. It was always a state police case. They're handled at the station level. Majority of our stations, at least here in our location, we have a 10-man criminal investigation unit, a BCI unit, and they're handled along with the regular cases that come in every day. Missing person cases are handled the same way. We have to go back. This is almost over 17 years ago. So things are a little different now. So, one of the first things we do now is try and work on the phone or some video or different things like that. We didn't have a lot of those things available back then. At least they were very limited compared to what we have now. We began basically ground searches, searches of the area, searches of the route that Audrey would have taken, or, her common route of travel coming back, thinking that, possibly she was off the road or something along those lines. We had helicopter up. We had canines. We had a lot of boots on the ground, a lot of foot labor. We did those types of things, as well as interviews of everyone. It was basically two facets of it. You had the uniform force, which were out doing most of the searches and different things, and then the investigators were talking to people at the long-term care, at the nursing home, talking to family members, doing the interviews.
It was mentioned earlier that Audrey had possibly left her purse behind at the house. Some people think this is suspicious, that most women wouldn't leave their purse behind. Could that mean that Audrey did make it home? We asked Investigator Fitzmaurice if he could clarify that for us.
I believe she had only taken like her license and some money with her. The phone was with her. From what I remember, and like I said, I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head, but she didn't carry a large purse with her that day. She took what she needed for work.
There's been a lot of talk about Jeff's cooperation with the police and lack of participation in the search efforts. Investigator Fitzmaurice told us more about Jeff's cooperation with them.
I would say that Jeff Heron's cooperation was, he cooperated to a point. He was not 100% fully cleared, and that kind of has hampered us a little bit, I think. If we had a little more cooperation or full cooperation, maybe we might be able to move in different directions, but we haven't been able to close that part of the case.
When someone goes missing and their vehicle is missing too, your first thought is always that it's an accident. And many of those close to Audrey thought the same thing. We wanted to know if they've been able to rule out that this could have been an accident.
I'm never going to say it's not a possibility only because of the types of, the area we live in. We have a lot of water. We have a lot of mountainous areas. We have a lot of hills and cliffs and a lot of, vacant land. But we're very confident with the route and the area around where she lives, where long-term care is, where these locations were, and the areas in between were searched exhaustively. I mean, it was the amount of manpower that was put into it. It's not in that location. Is there a chance she went somewhere else and, was doing an errand or something? That's always possible, but we don't know that. A regular person taking that route would be on a normal road, a nice level road, state highways the whole way back and forth, a little bit of town highways, getting over to the residence. But if you had taken a different route or, did something different that day, who knows what kind of road you take. There's a lot of different roads, not a lot of treacherous roads, but there's some variables out there.
Audrey has been missing for nearly two decades. Investigator Fitzmaurice told us more about what they continue to do to investigate her case further.
Depending on what happened, I guess, is the way to look at it. I mean, there's always somebody that has some piece of information or somebody that knows something that hasn't come forward, and sometimes it takes years for them to come forward. Or for us to even get to a point where we're able to act on something that we know about. I mean, we have guidelines and rules that we have to follow. So I don't believe that any case ever gets cold. I think you always, especially with Audrey's case, we've always actively worked it. Anytime anything's come in, we've always put somebody on it and made sure we followed up on it. And every year or so, we open it up and have fresh eyes look at it. And we try and rework what, might have been missed or if we can do something more. So, I mean, that's what we're trying to do with this one. I think eventually we'll get to a point, but I don't know how long.
So what happened to Audrey Mae Heron on that rainy night that she left work and got into her Jeep to drive home? Was she in an accident on the route she frequented on her commute and despite extensive searches has never been found? Did the man hanging around her work harm Audrey? Could someone have been hiding in her Jeep when she left work that night? Why didn't her husband Jeff search for her or cooperate fully with the police? Could Audrey have returned home that night and something happened to her there? Is there a connection to the Russian mob? Audrey's story has so many facets and twists that looking for answers only seems to add to the mystery. We had more questions for Investigator Fitzmaurice, but there was a lot that he couldn't comment on, like Jeff's polygraph exam and any calls he may have made from his home that evening. At the time of her disappearance, Audrey Mae Heron was 31 years old. She had light brown hair and hazel eyes. She was approximately 5 feet tall and weighed around 105 pounds. Also missing with Audrey is her vehicle, a 1994 black Jeep Grand Cherokee with the New York license plate X233UV. If you have any information about the disappearance of Audrey Heron, please call the New York State Police at 518-622-8600. You can follow Audrey's story on social media at Missing Mother of Three, Audrey Mae Turk Heron.
Collectively, I could say collectively for all of us, in the family and friends, I feel like we don't think that my mom just kind of ran off on her own. I think we all know that something happened to her, someone hurt her. I think all of our ideas about who and exactly what are different. You'll probably get conflicting ideas from everyone, but for the general consensus of us all, we don't think she just walked away.
I think that having Audrey home would be a miracle, although I would like justice too. So it's kind of like I'm selfish. I want both. I want to know what happened to her. I want to know where she is. I want to know who did it, why. I want to know everything. I don't understand. There are people that hurt other people. I just don't. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't think of her. Even after all these years, it still hurts. It would be great if, they had some more tips come in or some more information or some more proof or some more something. Anytime anybody wants to interview me, I do it. It's just to, see if anything does come in, and maybe someday her children would get answers.
If anybody has information about Audrey, whereabouts, or anything that can help us in working towards a conclusion on this case, we can be reached at the State Police Barracks in Catskill. Contact number is 518-622-8600, and you can just ask for a member of the BCI, the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. We also have a in Albany at the we have a tip line. That's NYSVICAP at troopers.ny.gov. They can remain anonymous, and they can only disclose whatever they want to.
That brings us to the end of episode 209. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join the discussion, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Kentucky. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.